You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
We're looking at just a few verses this evening, and we begin in chapter 12, verse 1, where he says, "Therefore," and that just that "therefore" is to bring what he's been talking about in chapter 11 into chapter 12. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily trips us up, and let us run with endurance the race God has set before us." So that is the idea of the race that God set before us. That's what these three verses are really all about. The idea that we're in a race. And what does it mean that we're in a race? What kind of race are we talking about here? Well, basically, it's the idea that God has at work in history. He's got a plan for humanity because we are broken, we are lost. We've got serious problems as humanity, and our loving Creator knows about and cares about those problems that we've got. Cares about the fact that we are lost, that we are far from Him, that we are corrupted from the very nature that He has created us to be. And we experience that within ourselves. We know that we're not right. We look at the world and we see that things aren't right. Things aren't the way that we know that they should be or could be. And God's at work dealing with that. And in the most central way, He's dealing with that through His own Son, through Jesus Christ, who He brought into the world, who lived the life of that we all do. He can relate to all the things that we experience. And then He died on our behalf. He took upon Himself the burden of God's judgment so that He could turn around then and offer us forgiveness and reconciliation with God. That's the plan of God that really begins as early as the beginning of the book of Genesis and works its way all the way through the end of the Bible. And the thing about God's plan is that He does it through people. That's why God became a man in Jesus Christ. And He continues to work through people. And that's the race that He's talking about here. That God has this plan that He has launched, that He has effected in Christ, and that He is communicating to the world through us. And therefore, we have a life of purpose to be stewards of this incredible message, to live this out before the watching world so that they see what does it look like to have God in our lives. And indeed, not just a purpose, but a responsibility as well. It's a stewardship that we are accountable ultimately to God for the gifts that He's given us, each one, to play our role in this incredible work that He is doing. And throughout the Scriptures and throughout the New Testament, we see God calling us out and saying, you know, what I'm doing is the important thing. And I'm calling on you to join in with me for this incredible work of changing the very landscape of eternity. Your lives matter. And so it's just an important thing for us to think about, because I think all of us as human beings have that internal sense that we want our lives to be connected with something real, something bigger than ourselves, something that makes our life purposeful and meaningful. And that inner sense is really something that comes from God. He created us to have that need to be connected to Him, to something that's real, something that is good and revolutionary. And so that's where our author is starting right here. And Paul, for instance, speaks of having finished the course. Also in 1 Corinthians 9, he talks about this idea that we're on this track. Like athletes, and that the idea here is to make ourselves capable of really running this race that is before us. And so it's really a pretty common metaphor in the New Testament that we are called to this race and that we're to run it. And the important part of this, it seems to me, is that to recognize that we're all in a race. And, you know, we used to talk about the rat race. I don't know if that's still a thing anymore, but it used to be a thing. It is a thing, she says. You know, that we're all pursuing something, right? We're all trying to find our way through. to some place that makes sense out of our lives and out of our endeavors. And so it really is not the question of whether you're in a race. The question is, what race are you in? And we're talking tonight then about God's race, and which is pretty sweet. He adds to this as well, this idea that it is, there's a lot of us in this thing. When we think about life's course, when we think about accomplishing the things that we want to accomplish in life, we're usually thinking in very individual terms. We're thinking about, what do I need to do? What am I called to do? What am I geared up and wired to do, right? And that is important. Individuals do matter. However, from the Bible's point of view, it's an us thing, that we do it together. It's the people of God cooperating with one another, working with one another in coordinated, interdependent activity, so that my calling and my purpose is never isolated from or independent of other people that God has in my life. I think that this is really important, because when we think about, have I run the race well? There can be an enormous amount of weight and pressure on our soul as we say, I don't know. That's a lot. But when we realize, what I'm called to is a community of people, and to play my role within that community to advance the purposes of God, it means that the responsibility and that stewardship, yes, it's individual. Yes, I am accountable to God. But it's distributed among my brothers and sisters. It's something that we do together. It's a language that we all have in common. It's a task that we all feel passionately about. And we share this together. And to me, that's where some of the real dynamic power of being in Christian fellowship is really rooted. It's in that place. Like-minded people striving towards the same ends. So I like the way that our author has kind of put a framework around what is this race that we're called to. Now, what we want to talk about in these three verses then is more of the how question. How do we run this race that is set before us by God? How do we, in other words, accomplish the purpose for which God has us in the world? That's kind of a big question, isn't it? How do we do that? Our author is going to point to five things that I think are really super critical to God's people at all stages, and definitely are relevant to us here tonight. Let's just begin then with the first. He says that we're surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith. So that how we conduct ourselves, how we run this race, is rooted in part in the forerunners, the people who've come before us. And again, that's coming at the tail end of our author's discussion in chapter 11 about all these people who've demonstrated the life of faith in the Old Testament, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. But it's important that we drill down here just a little bit more to recognize the importance of having mentors in faith. That the amount of biographical material in the Bible is substantial. We know a great deal about Moses, about David, about Jeremiah, Elisha, Elijah, the great figures of the Old Testament, because they're writing not only about their own lives, but they're also giving narrative about what's going on in their heart as they engage things that are difficult for them, as they're interacting with God and kind of show us what does it look like to live before God. And so I think it's just super beautiful, really, to read through the scriptures with biography in mind. What are you showing me, God, through the example of the faith of these great people that have come before, who deal with the kind of problems, different circumstances, of course, but in category, it's the same kind of thing that we deal with. That is what our author is trying to get us to contemplate. But that's not all that's involved in the huge cloud of witnesses that he describes here. We find that in looking at the lives of the people who've come before us, or maybe even our contemporaries, we see examples of courage, examples of generosity, of sacrificial service, of faithfulness. You know, all the things that we're confronted by and the decisions that we need to make about our lives, we're not the first ones to be in this place. There have been thousands of people over thousands of years who have come before us who've dealt with very similar things. And as we connect with their lives, it provides for us a way to be thinking about our own lives. And so the call to example occurs in the New Testament, for instance, 17 times. Follow this example. The Philippians are an example to the Corinthians about what it means to live generously. Jesus washes his disciples' feet and says, I've done this for you as an example of what it means to sacrificially serve one another. And so on and so forth like that. We learn by watching. We learn by the example of people who've come before us. And I think that that's really important for us to really consider, how is God instructing me through the examples of those who are around me, even now? We talk about the life of discipleship, of following Christ. A big part of what does it mean to follow Christ is to follow the example that God has provided for us in the people's lives who we're connected with. Years ago, I was thinking about this in a pretty focused way. And I just sat down before the Lord to say, thank you so much for your sovereign care of me over all of these years and the many people that you've brought into my life to show me the way. And at that point, I wrote down 18 people who had absolutely defining influence on my life. The things that I most appreciate about what God has done in my life has come through these people. And I think it's important if we are wanting to follow Christ, to be good students of what's happening in the lives of the people around us, those who God is bringing to us to be examples for us. As an example, at an early time in my Christian life, I was in a very difficult place. And I was pretty confused about what does it mean for me even to move forward and to live for Christ. And as I was thinking about this, I was coming up with zeros. I had no answer to that. And I was pretty despondent. And I sought out a group of fellas to say, hey, could you allow me to join in with you and to come alongside? And I need to find safe haven for my soul. And these are guys who knew me pretty well. And so the answer to them was fairly predictable. Yeah, no, not really. Except there was one guy who saw my despondency and appealed to these other brothers to say, you know, we need to look at this guy, not for where he's been, but where God could take him. To be willing to err on the side of grace and have a vision for someone who's at this stage pretty broken. That changed my life. Fundamentally, I would not be here tonight if it wasn't for that guy taking an interest in my life. And it was so defining for me that I have never forgotten it. A week does not go by in the 50 years since that happened where I had not remembered the kindness that was dealt to me through him, the mercy that was extended to me. And it has told me, it has taught me that the job one as a Christian in this world is to be agents of mercy and to look past what's broken to what could be in the lives of people that God has brought into my life. And so that's the kind of lesson I'm talking about. And there are many down to the present day in which I just continue to be instructed by God through that crowd of witnesses that continues to surround me. And not me, but you as well. All of us are in this place. And I think that there is this need then to learn what does it mean to observe, to get the lesson that God is trying to send to me through these people who are showing me different facets of what does it mean to follow God. So this is the first thing. We're inspired by our forerunners. And then he says, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sins that so easily trips us up. And this brings us to the second thing, which is that if we're going to run well, we need to be in training, right? To strip off the pounds, the weight. Not so fun. He brings up a couple things here that are important. Here's a question I want us to begin thinking about. Why have so many highly talented people run so poorly? You know, we need to think about that just for a sec. There are tons of super talented, gifted people, which when we think about this race that we're describing here, you realize, you know, here's a person that just has never really developed the kind of thing that they have the capacity to develop. Their potential has never been deeply realized. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, and so why is that? And the answer to that lies deeply in this point that our author is making right here. It is that it's so easy for us to become distracted. He says, strip off every weight that slows us down. There are plenty of good things that we could be about, and so we've got to learn to be a bit selective, and saying yes to things over here means saying no to something over there. Do you like chocolate cake? You do. But there's limits, right? No, she says. And yet there is. Because why? Because we got to say no to that if we're going to run this race. When I turned 40, whenever the hell that was, I thought, you know, I'm getting old. I need to start running. And so I did. I started running down over at Sharon Woods, nice 5K run. And I would run my thing, and I would stop at the end and pound some water and then light up a cigarette. Yeah, I'm that stupid. And it just became clear that these two things were just not compatible. So I stopped running. No. I set that smoking thing aside. And that's what he's talking about here. You know, there are a lot of things that are competing for our attention, our time, our loyalty, the shiny object that's always around us. And to run this race requires a bit of focus in which we say, you know, what really is important is that I'm in shape and that I'm able to run this race. And that might mean for me then that there are certain things that just are incongruous with this track that I'm on. And all of us are kind of in that place where we just have to make decisions like that to stay in the fight. There are certain things that disqualify us, that we're drawn to. I love the way he puts it. He says, the sin that so easily entangles us. Okay, so you maybe are not tempted by certain kinds of things that somebody else is, right? It's almost certainly true. But there are things that you are tempted by. Just saying. And these are the things that so easily trip us up. Things that are matters of conscience. Things that are just a part of our character that we are easily kind of bound by and tripped up by. And so it's these things that are maybe a priority for me in my conscience that might be different from you. So for instance, for me, in my broken character, I have a habit of going from isolated to alienated to bitter to angry. And so when I start feeling that sense of isolation and distance, when I start looking at people with that just a little bit of that critical eye that I was not having before, what am I realizing? I'm realizing that there are things like I'm tripping over. Those are warning signals to me that I'm unattentive to matters of the heart that are ultimately that will disqualify me from this race, that are going to take me out for a period of time. And our ability to be in relationship with one another, this is where this idea of the us is so significant, it seems to me, to have a dialogue going with people that we trust about these significant matters of the heart, so that we give them permission to say, you know, I'm seeing this pattern emerging in you. Maybe you're too close to it to see, but watch out, right? Do you have someone in your life who's got your back in this way? Who's able to just come to you and say, you know, I've been thinking about you and praying for you, and I have some observations I'd like to share with you, some things that I've seen. If we don't have that kind of connection with people, we are probably not going to be able to see, because the heart of humanity is so self-deceived. We see kind of what we want to see, right? And we justify the things that we know are a problem. And so our ability then to be able to engage these obstacles that are part of all of our lives really is going to make the difference between running this race well and falling flat on our face. And so we need to do what we need to do to have enough eyes on this thing that we are able to see those problems for what they are. Capiche? Now, let's move on. He says, let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. And so the focus here is on to endure. And this, this kind of comes to the reality that every one of God's people are going to face if we take this run seriously, because we run not in a vacuum, but against serious headwinds, against real opposition. I love what Paul says to the Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians 1. He says, we speak proudly of you to the churches of God because of your perseverance, your faith in the midst of all your persecutions and afflictions. Again, this appeal to example that he's talking about. And so this ability to endure becomes so important, and it becomes really important at various times of our lives. We're talking here about kind of hitting the wall in the middle mile. Hitting the wall is what runners experience after they've been running for a while, and now they're kind of reaching the natural limit of their cardiovascular output. And now the race has become a lot harder, right? So what do? You can stop, yes, or you can slow down a bit and press on and widen the extent of your lungs' ability to deliver oxygen and your heart's ability to deliver. And so the reality is that we are coming to a place, many of us, that has been called by many for a long time, the middle mile. It's those, okay, I'm past those kind of defining areas, moments of my life. Early on in my Christian life, early on in my chronological life. And now I've moved to a different moment. It's a little bit more complex. It's more difficult in some ways. It was easy to think about myself, but now I'm thinking about another person. And now we've got these little ones, they're running around too, and that's complicated. And then I've got this thing called a boss and accountability there, and I'm busy, and I'm doing all these things, and I wonder, where's my vision gone? You know, how does this all work out? You know what I'm talking about? And it really, you begin, this is why the term that was used so long ago is living lives of quiet desperation. With that gulf between this vision that I had for myself and the reality of my present circumstance. And part of that present circumstance is just the situation that's hard to kind of rethink and put stuff together. But then, too, part of it is that as we get a bit older, we begin to confront things about ourselves that we were able to avoid earlier in life. Earlier in life, we confront the really kind of difficult things that are clearly in the way that we need to part ways with if we're going to move forward with God. We call that the sex, drugs, and rock and roll phase. But then we move into this other phase where we are taking seriously our responsibilities across a broad spectrum of things. And we're still finding difficulty because we're finding that things are burbling up within us. They've been there all along. We just haven't seen them. But now these matters of the heart are there. And we realize just how selfish I actually am. How easily prone to anger I can become. How withdrawn and depressed I allow myself to be. Or fill in whatever blank it is for you. And so we have this kind of complex of things, and we begin to find satisfaction in many of the things that we do is a bit in decline as our confusion rises. And when I think about that situation, I think about Jeremiah. Here's a guy whose life we know 42 years of from his books in the Old Testament, Lamentations and Jeremiah. And right in the middle of this very tumultuous time in Israel's history at which he is living, and the incredible extent to which he is being rejected by the very people that he's called to, he begins to lament, and he calls out to God. And there's this really beautiful passage in Lamentations chapter 3 where he says that the Lord's loving kindness, the word here is hesed, the Lord's loving kindness, 180 times spoken in the Old Testament, it is central to our understanding of who God is. The Lord's loving kindness never ceases. His compassions never fail. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Why do I bring this up here? Because when we're really facing, I think, this difficulty to endure, our thinking either goes to the backwards, to the good old days, the way things were, or to some ideal future that isn't real anyway. And we're having a hard time living in the present. And we feel like I'm just not the fruitful person that I once was. The environment that I'm in is different. It's not getting the job done in the same way. That is not a new experience. That's what we would call something along the lines of universal experience among God's people. And what Jeremiah is pointing to is that while things have gotten complicated for him, God hasn't changed. That his love and his kindness to Jeremiah and even to the people who are rejecting him has not changed. And that indeed, he says, they're new every morning. There's a persistence in God's faithful love. And so there is a challenge then to say, if God is dishing out to me every day some sampling of his great compassionate love for me, then I need to have the eyes to see how he's doing that, what he's doing to demonstrate his incredible love and compassionate care for you. And I just think that that is really so important to making it through this time of life where we feel like it's a victory if I'm just able to keep one foot in front of the other. That's okay. But now let's be in that mode where we're actually saying to the Lord, I know that you are good. You have not changed. And that this difficulty that I'm feeling at this point, this huffing and puffing that I'm doing at this stage of my life, does not escape your notice. That you continue to move toward me. Help me see how that works. Let me understand how you're showing your loving kindness to me each day. If we are prepared to engage with God like that, then we will find our way through this confusing, difficult period in our lives. Thank God for that. And also, if we can be like this before God, we'll find that same outlook as we are living this way before God is the way that we then begin to realize, here's what God's calling me to at this moment of my life. to trust that God is good and generous and kind, and that I can be consistent in expressing that to Him and to the people engaged in my life. I can express how God is showing me that. And that is called being faithful. And that's what we just need to be, is faithful in these really difficult moments. Now, let's move on. He says in verse 2, he says, we do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. And so there's a focus here, what we call a vertical focus. You know, it's important that we understand that what he's talking about is to, he said, the, some translations have it more, I think, accurate, to fix our eyes, to set our gaze. You know, a runner is looking for that rope, that line across the finish line, right? And they're bending into it, and they see it, and in seeing it, it's like, that's very motivating. Well, to run the race that we have with God, it's Christ who we keep our eyes fixed upon. And what does that mean? It means that our core motivations and our power to run this race are relational and not functional. What I mean by that is that, yes, there are important things we need to do. There are competencies we need to develop, absolutely. But at the end of the day, our ability to run well is a function of our relationship, how we're connecting with Jesus, that enables us to put everything that we're involved with in context. It enables us to have the kind of the same motivation that Jesus himself had, that we are able to have a power that comes not from ourselves, but the power of God to work in us and through us. And here's the thing, if we are concerned about a race that involves really significantly influencing other people, which is what this race is all about, what we will find is that what is most compelling to people around us is less how articulate perhaps we are, how persuasive we are in our speech, how right on we are in various ways, how charismatic our personality is. Those things, there's a value in that. I don't want to diminish it. But what really affects people's lives and helps them see Jesus through you is our ability to have advancing in our understanding of Christ, our connection with Him, our delight in His Word and the insights that come in our time with Him, and just that freedom of spirit to share the sweet things that we are learning and being changed by. And that is the wake that draws people forward. That's the real influence that we can and really need to be having as Christians in our Christian community and in the broader society that we're called to. That people sense something that is moving in us and through us, though they may not understand fully what that is that they sense. There's something real here. Yeah, and that's what he's talking about. That's the focus. It's a vertical focus as opposed to a horizontal one. In other words, it's not about having all the right methods and doing all the right things. Again, that's not unimportant. But at the core of it is what's going on with me and Jesus that is giving me a sense of clear motivation because I'm hearing from God and a power that I did not possess before to be used by Him. That's what he's talking about here. He's talking about keeping our eyes on Jesus because of the joy awaiting him. He was prepared to endure the cross. And that attitude rubs off. Jesus went through excruciating. That's where the cross means. The word excruciate comes from cross. He was prepared to involve himself voluntarily in enormous pain, not because he was some kind of a martyr, but because he understood that in sacrifice, something that is being accomplished that could be accomplished in no other way. And that is that someone who is far from God and really super broken, like you and everyone you know and me, can become a child of God. And so from Christ's point of view, I will absolutely involve myself in great pain. I'll go to the cross. I'll take undeserved punishment as a substitute for the guilt of all of the people that God has created and who have gone the wrong way, which is the whole human race, knowing that there will be some and many who will respond to the offer of forgiveness, who will be willing to say, yes, God, for me to be right with you, I've already blown that opportunity, and I just want to receive mercy. And Jesus is like, I purchased that mercy for you. All I'm asking you to do is receive it. That's all there is. That's all there is. And so we are told then in the scriptures that when a person in their heart approaches God in that humble way and asks for that kind of mercy, that there is joy. Luke chapter 15 is a story of joy. A number of incidences, the parables that Jesus gives, of things that are lost, that are precious to its owner, and which are found, culminating in the prodigal son, in which the story goes that when the son returns home, the father puts on a feast, and he rejoices. And that is the heart of God. He's not saying, man, you really owe me for your screwed upness, right? No, he's saying, I'm just so delighted that you're back. Joy. And that sense of joy then needs to animate us in this race that we're running. A joy, a delight in seeing, however incrementally perhaps, people advancing as they seek to follow Christ, or if they find Christ. And that abiding sense of joy really sustains us as we involve ourselves in this race that is, very difficult, with the knowledge of what the outcome of the story is. He says, now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. We know how the story ends. And so because we know that it ends like this, we're prepared to stay in the fight. The future's not in doubt. In 2001, the Buckeyes and the Hurricanes in the national championship. I was so upset during that game. Me and a friend went outside. It was freezing outside. It was really cold. And we're literally looking through the window because we just couldn't be around people. And that's like, they're going to lose. Oh, they're going to win. They're going to lose. Oh, they're going to win. It was, I aged several years that window of time. And then, of course, there was this incredible victory. But you know what I did? Yeah. YouTube. I've gone back and back and back and back and watched that game with great relish and delight. Because I know the end of the story, right? I'm not in agony as I watch it. I'm just waiting to see how all of those dramatic pieces fit into this incredible victory. That's really kind of the way it is from God's point of view. He's got this thing under control. We know who wins. And so we can put our situation, however dramatic, in that framework of victory. Last point. He says, think of the hostility that he endured from sinful people. Then you won't become weary and give up. This is the last thing he says. The word think here is significant. It's the word that we is transliterated in English to analogize. In other words, it's like connecting the dots between Christ and you. He's saying, see in what God is calling you to, what you've seen in Christ. And so there's something worth reflecting on and kind of meditating on that he ends this section with that is significant. We want to be able to connect the dots from Jesus' experience to our own. And specifically the experience, he says, of enduring sinful people so that we will not become weary and give up. And so what is he talking about here? He's talking about having open-eyed calculation. He's saying, we know that pursuing this path, this race, will not be the easiest thing that we could choose. We could just sit on our ever-expanding butt and watch TV for till the end of our life. Okay? I don't recommend that. It would be very unfulfilling, unsatisfying. We could pursue a lot of different kinds of things. But if we choose to respond to the race that God has for us, it will, by definition, involve a certain amount of hostility. It means that people, just as they find themselves not neutral about God, will not be neutral about us as God's mouthpiece as well. And so to be prepared for that is what he's ending this section on. I think it's significant. I want to say a couple things about it. Namely, I want to talk about Oscar and Cephas. Cephas is the short guy. Oscar is the big guy. These guys live in Zambia in Central Africa. And a few months ago, I spent a week with them and learned some things about what they are doing. They grew up in a small Christian environment in a village in Zambia. And as childhood friends, they prayed about what does the Lord have for us? What kind of role can we be playing in what God is doing in Africa? And by the time they had finished high school, they concluded that God was giving them a vision and calling them and several of their friends to be Christian ambassadors in the difficult places of Africa. Their belief was that it is Africans that God has called to reach Africa. So Cephas went to Libya, and Oscar went to Chad. And Chad is just at the base of the Sahara Desert. It's a pretty rough place to be. And in a specific place called the Darfur region, which is the borderlands between Sudan and Chad. And during the 1990s and early 2000s, this was a very tough place to be because civil war was happening everywhere. So Cephas goes to this war-torn place and begins to meet practical needs. And early in his time there, this is a 99.99999999% Muslim population. And very militant. And so it was clear that here this guy Cephas is an outsider. We're wondering what's he up to. And so he's warned early on, keep your faith to yourself, or we will kill you. And they were not kidding. So for 8 years, Cephas, as a Christian believer, just meeting very practical needs. God loves you. I love you. Well, 8 years into this, a war breaks out between rival militias. The UN leaves. All the Christian aid organizations leave. There is no one left in this region of Chad to help except our man, Cephas. And so for a period of many months, very much on the down low, he's giving food to people who are hungry. He's meeting very practical needs. And over the course of months, the guns go silent. Peace, whatever that means in this context, is restored. People start coming out. And slowly and individually, dozens of people start coming to Cephas and said, Everyone left when we had our time of need, but you stayed. And now we know you love us. And we want to hear what you have to say about God. And for the next several years then, in a very down low way, off the grid, in a relational environment, one-to-one, Cephas began to share his faith with these people. And today there are over 250 people who have come from this background into a real believing underground Christian community. They continue to give witness to their friends, their family. It's a huge victory for the things of God. Why do I bring this to your attention? Because this is exactly what our author is talking about. To endure in the face of hostility, to have that long view of what God is doing, to be able to be faithful, as we were saying a few minutes ago, faithful to love in a consistent way people irrespective of their response, and to have the long game, realizing that God is at work. Finally, I'm going to introduce you to Jim Elliot. Jim Elliot wrote a now sort of famous journal entry in October 28, 1955, where he said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose." He's talking about his life. And he's saying, you know, if God has called us, wherever God has called us, that may mean danger. That may mean even potentially the loss of life. But better to lose your life, because you're going to lose it anyway. Right? You're going to lose it anyway. So why not give it to something that will last forever, that cannot lose, cannot fade away? 2 months after he wrote this journal entry, he and three of his friends went into eastern Ecuador in the Amazon jungle to a group of people called the Aka Indians, who had zero contact with the outside world, had never met anyone outside their tribe, ever. And so here they are, they show up. Are they met with handshakes and the exchange of gifts? No, they're met with arrows and they die. And not long after that, another group of their missionary associates followed up into that village to reclaim their bodies and to explain what they were unable to explain because of the quickness of the execution. They talked about Jesus. And the Aka Indians today are the most believing tribal community in the Western Hemisphere. And I say this not because God's calling you to the Amazon or to Southern Chad or wherever that might be. Well, maybe he is. But maybe he's just calling you across the street. And you're having trouble feeling that might be a little bit too much, a little too risky, a little bit too hard. Or to have that conversation with somebody who you know you're going to get pushback from, but they still need to hear. And we get these examples because they show us the faithfulness of God to anyone who is willing just to take a step, to trust Him, to be in that space. And that's really what Hebrews 12, 1-3 is really all about. And I just find that these examples, from my own home church experience to biblical history to partners that we have around the world in various ways, God is just always calling on us to open our eyes and to see this is the way forward. It's being demonstrated for you. It's being shown to you. And I just think that this is the sweetest thing about being a part of the community of faith is that God has given us a cloud of witnesses to guide our way. Let me pray for us. Lord, just thank you so much for this opportunity to focus here on this race that you've called us to. God, just help us to enthusiastically embrace the opportunity that we have to make our lives count for eternity, that indeed through us you are shaping the very contour of eternity. And just help us to understand in the moment that you're invested in us, that you are at work in us and through us, and that we would have the eyes to see what you're calling us to today and tomorrow, and that maybe that through that a pattern of observations will translate into a pretty clear path for our lives. But thank you the fact that we just are not into this place that's just random and pointless, but we have a real finish line to anticipate. So we thank you for these things in Christ's name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.